How good is Australia?
Well, not many people saw that one coming. For almost 3 years, Labor has led the coalition in all the published opinion polls, including those in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. And going into last Saturday, Bill Shorten was tipped to be the next Prime Minister.
I know that you're all hurting, and I am too.
On Tuesday afternoon, the Liberal Party retained the marginal seat of Chisholm, handing a majority to Scott Morrison's re-elected coalition government. A victory hard fought for, which Morrison himself attributed to divine intervention.
I have always believed in miracles.
For nearly 6 years, Shorten worked day and night to keep the Labor caucus united as he literally ran all over the country talking to voters. And just like that, it was all over.
Whilst I intend to continue to serve as the member for Maribyrnong, I will not be a candidate in the next Labor leadership ballot.
So what happened? Where did it all go right for the coalition and wrong for Labor? And will we ever trust opinion polls again?
There was a clear path to us being able to win this election. It was a very narrow one. It was a bit like walking along the edge of a razor blade for eight months.
This is Please Explain. I'm Tory Maguire. Joining us later is Jess Elgood, the director of Ipsos, which does the Herald and Age's polling, to explain how they and all their competitors called this election wrong. First, though, to help me dissect the campaign and the results in Saturday's election, I'm joined by two very experienced political campaigners, one from each side, Lachlan Harris and Peter Schmeagel. Lachlan Harris is the co-founder and CEO of consumer network One Big Switch. In an earlier life, he was a senior advisor to Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. Peter Schmeagel has been a senior advisor to 8 Liberal ministers or premiers and has been CEO of 3 NGOs, including the one he runs at the moment, the Australian Council of Recycling. Peter also once worked for the Liberal-aligned polling and strategy company Crosby Texter. Between the two of them, they have seen more than one or two campaigns. Peter, Lachlan, thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
My
to
first
be here.
Question is, what went so right for Scott Morrison, Lachlan?
Bill Shorten, I think, unfortunately, and a whole lot of other series of things. There is no one simple answer that ever is with election wins or losses, but fundamentally, the election is a choice between two potential prime ministers. And I think ultimately he kind of was, for a series of complex reasons we can tease out, but he was a more attractive choice on the day than Bill Shorten. And so fundamentally you have to say is that was the driver of the outcome that made Scott Morrison achieve his miracle.
Peter, do you think Scott Morrison won the election or Bill Shorten lost the election?
I'm going to agree with Lachlan in the first instance. It's never one thing in a campaign.
Yeah.
And that's true in terms of answering your question. Lachlan mentioned that there are some more complex factors. And so, for example, one of the things that we talk about a lot on the Liberal side, when based on the research, based on polling, based on focus groups, is three factors: competency, integrity, and stability. So when you look at competency, integrity, and stability, and you compare the two guys who are in the contest, you know, they kind of came neck and neck on competency. On integrity, they kind of came neck and neck. Nobody was seen essentially as a liar or misleading the public, et cetera, et cetera. And then the fascinating thing was stability, where everybody basically wrote the Libs off after three prime ministers and however many years. And yet, through the miracle of Scott Morrison, he managed to negate that perception of instability, and in fact, I would suggest win that category. Mm. I would suggest that Scott Morrison won the election based on the fact that he could mount and demonstrate that he was actually the more stable of the two leaders.
And how did he do that? Was it in his demeanor or his policies or what he said?
For one of the things that we find when we go through a lot of research is there's kind of like a positivity deficit in the country and a hope deficit in the country. You know, folks like what's going on in Australia, but they feel anxious about their lives as well. And they're looking for somebody who can come along and kind of reassure them about, you know, where we are in the world and what our future looks like. And, you know, one thing you got to credit Scott with a hell of a lot in this campaign is the relentless positivity about our lives,
how good
about
is
our
Australia?
Country. How good is it? You know, and, you know, it might sound trite to those of us, you know, who are more sort of cognoscenti and, you know, we call ourselves warriors of the word on Twitter and stuff like that. But you know what? Not on Twitter, but in Toowoomba, that message of, you know, we've got it right and we should be proud of stuff really resonates.
And I would say, look, he may have also started a long way ahead, not just Scott Morrison, but the Liberal Party itself or the Liberal National Coalition. I don't mean even in this election is, I always think when you look at election results, you first question you ask is the structural sort of question is, and on the structural issues, Labor's long-term declining primary vote, the rise in the Greens and the fact that the Greens are not assisting Labor directly and really as any kind of a cooperative partner to deal with that climate change issue is Labor's primary vote has been declining for 20 years. Actually, really, you could say it's been declining since the 1950s. It was in the 50s. It slowly moved down through the mid-40s and really basically Hawke got to 39. That's the lowest primary vote Labor's ever formed government with. And then since then, if you take out the Kevin Rudd blip, Labor's primary vote has been on a relentless and terminal decline. And Bill Shorten didn't create that. That has been happening for years and years and years. And so I think he actually, and with inside the Labor Party, I think Kevin Rudd, for a whole lot of series of reasons, some built around Kevin, a lot around to have to do with John Howard's longevity, allowed us to delude ourselves that that structural decline in our primary vote wasn't a major fundamental existential problem. I think that actually caught up with us on Saturday night, and that has nothing to do with Bill's personality or Bill anything. It's just the fundamental core proposition that the Labor Party is presenting is appealing to a good 10 to 15% less than it did for a very long time when we used to form majority government.
We will get to the polling and the flaws in the polling a bit later, but just on one part of it, the Ipsos poll has actually had the Labor vote very low over the last year,
yep,
and no one believed it. Every time we published the Ipsos poll, everyone set their hair on fire saying your Labor vote, your Labor primary is too low.
And there was an open conversation. There was an absolute open conversation within Labor Party circles the entire time. Every comment about the election will be prefaced with, if Ipsos is right, we're stuffed, but we're all assuming it's not. You know what I mean? And really, actually, that was an incredibly naive statement, and we all have to take responsibility for that, is because Ipsos was reflecting a very, very well-established long-term decline. There was nothing unusual about the 33. When you stop reading the paper and you look back at history, and actually it was almost, if you had to guess Labor's primary vote on the day of the last election of the 2016 election, and you looked, had nothing to guess on other than previous data, you would come up with about 33.3%. So the only thing that made it unpredictable, this result, was the short-term polls. The long-term pattern almost made this result inevitable.
I think Lachlan's onto something in terms of structural decline, but I'd suggest that it's not something that's only specific to the Labor Party. So reality is, you know, Libs and Nats also struggle to get to 40% nowadays. When you look at state polls, et cetera, and you look at the kind of vast swings you've seen in places like Queensland and state polls, et cetera, et cetera. So my view is that both major political parties and our entire political process is, in fact, struggling with a post-ideological world. You know, the notion of a left and a right, you know, we talk about it, folks on Twitter talk about it. You know, when's the last time that you sat in a focus group and you actually had somebody talk about the left and the right? Bullshit, never happens, right? So folks are actually looking at the world in non-ideological terms. Hence, you know, their rusted on loyalty to the parties is no longer there automatically. So basically, the vectors are changing from working class and non-working class and left and right to things like, is it tangible or is it abstract? Do I trust them? Don't I trust them? Is it a real thing or is it just a fucking promise, right? And both parties have to actually struggle and work their way through that new dynamic to get what is now not a 20% swing in the middle, but a 40 and 50% swing in the middle.
That structural challenge doesn't abrogate the other things we talked about, the personality deficit, the personality challenges that Shorten has had since day one, the policy stuff and the way that policy was pitched. And that's what's so confusing about elections is all of those lessons and all of those points can be true. And actually, even trying to, what you could maybe hope for is to rank them in importance, but the idea you're going to narrow it down to one of those is completely farcical. And actually, maybe you kind of pull out, if you're lucky, one or two pieces of actionable intelligence out of the campaign. But I would argue you had structural challenges, you had personality factors playing a very strong role, you then had some policy factors and the way that policy was pitched, and all four of those things in a way that is extremely complex interact in a way that actually made the outcome of the election entirely predictable, except one thing: the polls weren't accurate. And so really what we're learning about in this election more than anything else is polling. There was nothing in any of those things that fundamentally made the election result exceptional or unusual in any way. It's just that none of us predicted it because we dud and downed our political instincts because of the polls.
Right.
And that was a big mistake. That is the big unknown out of this campaign. The result's not that surprising if you take that away.
I'm going to add one more to that sort of laundry list of potential explanations. And I agree, there's never a single one. And that is, from a technical perspective, the Libs just trounced Labour from a campaigning point of view. You know, we're learning that in the Financial Review over the last couple of days. You know, just the thought of a Liberal campaign team admitting a journalist into the inner workings and saying, this is how we're making decisions and this is how we operate, reveals a fundamental cultural difference in the organizational cultures of one organization compared to the other when it comes to winning at the moment. We're living now in what I call the by the Tao of techs. You know, Mark Texter, the greatest living campaigner that Australia has ever produced, has basically trained a whole generation of campaigners. Seven of them were working in campaign headquarters, as well as Crosby Texter being engaged as the official pollster. There is a massive advantage for the Liberal Party and the National Parties when they have that kind of intellectual history, corporate history, huge training, massive discipline, as opposed to basically what we're seeing from Labor is they're building brand new campaign teams at every cycle.
So for most of us who've never been inside a campaign war room, how does it operate? How does a good one operate?
Really quietly, you know, really quietly.
Why are you laughing, Lachlan?
Oh, just thinking, yeah, how do they operate? It's a bit of like, well, those, you know, Churchill has this great line when he was asked, what was the strategy to win the Second World War? And because he won it, he said, I don't know, whatever happened was the strategy. And that's pretty much what happens in elections is like, you know, they verge between like absolute science to complete chaos. And sometimes, you know, I fundamentally agree with all those points Pete raised is, you know, there is a huge advantage to doing it more than once. But obviously, I remember, funnily enough, after 2007, that exact criticism was used to basically say that's why they lost, not won, you know what I mean? Because they hadn't refreshed their campaign teams. Look, I don't think there's any doubt. I don't think anyone could seriously argue that the Liberal Party didn't out-campaign the Labor Party in this election because they so clearly trounced them.
Yeah.
So they did.
Did it look like that to you while it was happening, though? Or is it in hindsight that
I think everyone accepted Scott Morrison was having a good campaign. I never heard anyone who's serious about politics not argue that Scott Morrison was having a good campaign every single day of the campaign. I don't think he was having such a good campaign that everyone thought, oh, my God, this is – because some campaigns can turn on a dial. What I'd say is campaigns are a bit like football teams, is there isn't a good campaign. There isn't a rule book for good campaigns. There's campaigns that are good because of the interaction of all the different parts of that campaign and the chemistry is right. And there's certain fundamental underlying rules, but it's that miracle chemistry that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And clearly Hirstie on this campaign pulled that all together and executed the campaign that did that. And you cannot take that away from them. It was exceptionally well executed. There's no doubt about that. And the reason I would say that is because fundamentally, look back on the campaign, no one ever asked any questions about Morrison's campaign. That's how you know you've had a good campaign, when no one ever talks about your campaign. And I can't think of a day where actually the conversation that Morrison was trying to start ever really went away from that fundamental core point. Because the real job of the campaign is to define the questions voters are asking themselves. And that is very hard to do. And if they're in any way the part of the conversation themselves, what you're trying to do, how you're trying to do it, who you are, any of that stuff comes through, you've fundamentally lost. All you want to be doing is defining the question that the voters are asking themselves, particularly the undecided voters on election day. And you have to say Scott and the entire campaign team behind him did an excellent, excellent job at doing exactly that.
Yeah, and again, I posit that it's experience and established methodologies and people just stepping back into roles that they've done time and time again versus kind of making it up as you go along based on, oh, the Democrats are doing this at the moment, so we might give it a go. Big data, big deal. We've been doing big data in this country for 30 years, right? So to give you a couple of examples, we, on our side, rubbed our hands in glee when we saw Christina Keneally turn up on the campaign.
Right.
I'm like, what?
Who thought that was a good idea?
What in the world? You know, we've had internal polling since 2011 showing that she drives votes to us. Even though journalists love her, and she's probably a really nice person. She's probably quite competent person, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and maybe that's her. That's why they needed her, is to structure kind of campaign messaging and, you know, do the media stuff. But boy, oh boy, you know, out in Penrith, or Emu Plains, as she once famously referred to it, Emu Plains, folks do not like her. That was one. I mean, you know, the other one that we kept on wondering about is, why do you keep bringing the message back to taxes and the economy? You know, it is a truism of campaigning that one party owns a certain set of issues and the other party owns the other set of issues. And every time that you talk about the other party's issues, you're doing it a favor. Basic rule of combat. You choose your battlefield. Don't fight on the other guy's battlefield. So every time the Labour Party talked about taxes, we would go, thank you.
Right.
In many ways, the campaign strengths and weaknesses from the from 16 kind of flipped into 19, very interestingly.
Perfect, absolutely.
And so you had this, two things I took out of it straight away. I remember looking on campaign, on election night. This often happens. It takes a second election to learn about the one previous. The first very clear message is, wow, Malcolm Turnbull was extremely, in a matchup. This is not a deep criticism of a person, but he was a very weak prime ministerial candidate in an election against Bill Shorten. That's become very clear from the 2019 result, because Shorten himself, obviously, was a weak candidate who did, who, and that was shown up by Scott's campaigning. The second thing is, Labor, in many ways, we all, at the end of 16, I think everyone was shocked that the Libs hadn't gone really hard and really negative on Bill. And Labor executed quite a good negative kind of campaign around Medicare and those issues. And then in this case, it sort of seems like Labor decided not to execute a very, very targeted, very kind of, to be willing to execute hard in on the Libs on their kind of instability kind of issues, and moved into a much more dangerous area around policy. And that was the exact same mistake that Turnbull made in 16. And we kind of did, we learnt our lesson too much and didn't learn their lessons. And they may have, unfortunately, didn't make the same mistake and they got overlined.
Labor made themselves an enormous, very unwieldy target, didn't they? I mean, there was many different ways that the government was able to hit them in this campaign on policy.
Yeah, and I think they were trying to super compensate there for the underlying popularity issue with Bill. And so they were pushing these ideas up. I'm not totally convinced that ideas always, it's how you tie those ideas together, I think, is very, very important. And I think a huge mistake was to make all of those ideas about singularly about redistribution. I think that was ginormously risky. I think in another world where they were part of growing a bigger and fairer economy, where we're all going to benefit more, and obviously you've got to have a hell of a story to tell that story with franking credits is hard, but maybe possible. But tying up very large fundamental tax changes to this big end of town, punishing the big end of town language, I think was incredibly dangerous and was very, very old-fashioned for Labor. And I think that really is a much more profound error than any of the individual policies that were in that. And it's going to be hard for Labor to learn that, because they don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But I think the pitch around the policy program was much more a source of weakness than the policy program itself.
You know, fundamental rule of any kind of communication and marketing is you have to explain why you're doing something, not just the what you're doing. So, you know, perhaps that's a criticism to take on board of the Labor policy package, is that there was a lot of what, you know, we're going to do this X, we're going to do this Y, franking credits, et cetera, et cetera. But it didn't, as Lachlan rightly says, didn't tie back to that fundamental notion of, why are you doing this? Okay, so if it's about a fairer and juster country, if it's about, you know, a greater emphasis on funding of social programs or establishment of equity and stuff like that, that was kind of taken for granted in the narrative. And we were left with just the detail of the technicalities of these policies, which make for wonderful targets, because, you know, the more of that stuff you put out there, the more your opponent can just pick the hell out of it.
In many ways, Labor may look back at the Banking Royal Commission and realize that what the Banking Royal Commission did was, it gave them such a simple narrative, you know what I mean? And they made the mistake of, actually, they piled in all of their policy agenda behind a narrative which really was built, really they took that from the Banking Royal Commission. And there's a big difference between, like, hey, this is a good reason to have a Royal Commission, aren't those bankers bad, to, like, make me the Prime Minister and I'm going to do all these big fundamental economic moves. And they basically used the same narrative, right? And that, and it was probably because it was so intoxicatingly simple and easy, and felt like a kind of, it had this incredibly powerful narrative arc over a thing the size of a royal commission. What it didn't have, just did not have the firepower to actually survive an election campaign and to give them a right to govern.
And you can talk about bashing the big end of town when you're talking about the banks, but you can't talk about bashing the big end of town when you're talking about upper middle class people who you're going to tax. Yeah, well,
if the Royal Commission had suddenly announced they were going to dump franking credits, let me tell you, it wouldn't have worked then, but Royal Commissions can't do that. And so that's the narrative was not big enough to sustain the policy agenda, which is different to saying the policy agenda, without doubt, was kind of completely wrong-headed. Now, and I'm not defending every element of it or suggesting they should have done everything, but that was the bigger mistake in my book, was the pitch, not the policy agenda. But
plus, again, you know, again, go back to, it's a post-ideological world. There's not so much left-right analysis. People don't look at things that way. They look at things extraordinarily practically. Is it tangible? Is it real? That's the only way I can tell if something is truthful or not in the world of fake news, et cetera, yeah. Not that Nine or anybody else like that participates in anything like that. So, for example, when you wheel out the line, the big end of town, and you're living in one of the many, many coastal communities up and down the Queensland coast, and that's why we have so many marginal seats in Queensland, is because they are these kind of self-sustained towns, right? And you say big end of town, you're actually talking about your next door neighbor. Mm.
Your employer.
Yeah, whereas in Sydney, well, you can kind of say, oh, big end of town, that's Vaucluse and that's Mossman and da-da-da, and you kind of can visualize that and you can kind of, you know, get up your hatred nicely around all that. You can muster your emotion around it. In a place like Queensland, it's literally the tradie who's living across the street who's doing really well and's got two jet skis and a nice pickup.
And we picked that up, like, because obviously we're going through a bit of a post-mortem ourselves in relation to polls, which we'll talk about in a second. But the most valuable thing we did during the campaign was send one of our reporters to Queensland. He flew to Cairns and he drove down the coast and over, you know, a week and a half. And he wrote a story halfway through the campaign saying Labor is in dire, dire trouble in Queensland. And that was the most valuable piece of information we got during the campaign.
I was about to say, I mean, we're going to have to tackle it here. You've got to tackle the Victorian issue. Mm. Like, I think it's possible Labor may have to conclude that barring some once-in-a-generation incredible figure, federal Labor cannot form government with a leader from Victoria.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think, and you could go further and say they cannot form government without one from Queensland.
I don't think you have to go that far yet. Mm. I think a great leader from Queensland. Now, it depends where Labor goes in the future, because a future Labor government may decide all of its majority governments are going to come from the, you know, the existing place plus the Rohingyas of the world and others that fall over time. That's a very different Labor party. But if Labor wants to win on its existing model, then I just think Victoria it's a very, very, very rare politician that can come from that Victorian base and execute a national campaign with all of Labor's vulnerabilities. I think it would be easier for a Liberal, much easier, because of their policy base. But our ideological challenges make a Victorian leader particularly vulnerable to that Queensland blindness, basically.
Mate, you're really portraying a really stark picture about the Labor Party today. I got to say, you're kind of surprising me in that regard.
I'm
actually going to ask you a genuine question. I mean, a quote from a recently retired politician who may have represented the northern beaches of Sydney, who at one point said, there's nothing wrong with the Liberal Party that a good win wouldn't fix. Mm. You know, my sense of the Labor Party is, you know, given its long-term values, given, you know, the critical role that it plays in the society, together with an individualist and market standpoint that the other guys represent, I actually don't see anything that's terminal there, right? Well, it's just that the Labor Party, just like us, is trying to cope with a really strongly shifting sociological and demographic mix.
But you have a coalition, which makes it a lot easier to deal with these issues. So Labor's great challenge is when it was originally formed, the Labor Party, its idea of this sort of caucus discipline and the pledge and all, it was radically disruptive, and that was where the unity came from, and that institutional breakthrough was hugely important to Labor's dominance for many years. That is now becoming a huge vulnerability, and so the coalition, the nature of the LibNat coalition, and the informal, even kind of quite frankly semi-hostile relationship with One Nation and others, is that in a world where ideology is slipping and people are becoming more, balkanized voting patterns, that infrastructure is hugely valuable now.
And to answer those pragmatic questions
and to have slightly different messages in slightly different places, to have the Barnaby saying one thing and to have, you know, Josh Frydenberg saying another, and to be able to do that in a way, it gives you flexibility that is, without being ridiculous. And it actually, when you look at, to me,
but your left-right
structural organization doesn't give you that same coherence.
Absolutely not,
to message
because the nature of caucus
areas?
Discipline and the pledge is if you cross the floor, if you're saying, I think that's a bad policy, we're going to have a slightly different policy, you're out.
And the voters wouldn't know in the Labor Party who was from the left and who was from the right.
This is true. No, and so for
me, as I've argued here,
it's not some fundamental pessimism about Labor's mission or anything like that. It's just that, like, in the new world order, as voting patterns change more and more and more, that single party dominance. So, like, if you were just the Liberal Party, you would have been like, you would have had this existential nightmare years ago. Like, the primary vote is nowhere near sufficient to form government. And our problem now, Labor's problem, is our structure doesn't allow us to walk and chew gum at the same time. And I would argue to win the kind of the Labor seats that we need to win to hold the Greens off and to win in Victoria means it's very hard to walk in Victoria and chew gum in Leichhardt and Longman and kind of those areas.
So Lachlan, the logical conclusion of what you're suggesting here is effectively a restructure that's a schism of the Labor Party in some respects, whether it's along ideological lines or geographical lines.
Labor has to look for partners. I think it has to go to that. I think that is the hard lesson. Look, a lot changed. If Bill had won, I think then Kevin didn't look like a blip, and then the long-term patterns looked like they weren't happening. But unfortunately, I think Bill's result makes Kevin's look like very much a blip in a long-term structural change. And I think, yes, Labor now has to admit to itself, we have to look for partners that we can work with to allow us to negotiate this new world voting order where there's very, very clear demarcations. And that's going to be a very hard lesson to learn. But I think we're there. The complex thing is the Greens are the worst possible. They are not that partner. And this is not, I'm not some Green hating. Mm. It's just the Greens' economic agenda and
it's
their kind
radical.
Of their other. So it's too radical. Mm. It will do the opposite. It would be
them.
Like the Liberal Party going with One Nation. It would kill the kind of fundamental, it would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Mm. But we don't have another option on the left. We either have to create it, we have to find it, we have to look for it, we have to kind of work out a way to find a rational partner.
Or a reverse takeover of the ALP by GetUp.
No, but GetUp had a terrible campaign.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Apart from Warringah,
GetUp is one of the biggest losers out of the last cycle.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no,
so did the unions.
And they elected a member in Zali Steggall that basically has disowned them in her first public comments.
Yeah, no, but forget about GetUp, but the Zali Steggall kind of vote, whatever that was, Labor has to work out a way to informally benefit from that. And it's kind of like with the Nats, right? They're separate entities. They run against each other in vacated seats, yada, but fundamentally one's not trying to govern over the other. And one is not totally toxic to the other. Whereas the Greens would be toxic to Labor in Queensland. They're the worst. They're going to have to find a structure that allows them to empower the Zali Steggalls of the world. And it's happening informally now. Labor was indirectly involved in the election of Karen Phelps, has been indirectly involved. And I mean, like, allocating resources to make that happen, like not that indirectly. It's got to happen. And that to me is the harder conversation with Labor was, you know, franking credit's a problem. Yeah, it probably was. And, you know, was Bill unpopular? Yeah, he was. But solve all of that, you still have this fundamental underlying problem. We used to get 50% of the vote. Then it was 40. Then it was high 30s. Now it's low 30s. No one ever is forming government with a primary vote of 33.
Core working class constituency decreasing in its overall size and changing in its outlook at the same time that new constituencies aren't emerging to build the alliances that you're talking about. It's very tough.
And you guys are effectively repositioning very, very clearly into that kind of... I mean, I thought Tony Abbott, you know, he was very interesting, his concession speech.
We can see that there is something of a realignment of politics going on right around this country. It's clear that in what might be described as working seats, we are doing so much better. It's also clear that in at least some of what might be described as wealthy seats, we are doing it tough and the Green Left is doing better.
The way I would describe that is like, clearly, the Libs and Nats are repositioning much more strongly into what would have been Labor's traditional base. You know what I mean? And that is it's a bit like the Democrats and the Republicans in the South in the US in the 60s. That change is making this need for a new partner out here on the left of the Labor Party.
Mate, you're depressing me.
you're
depressing me. I mean, I came to this country and I was introduced to the Labor Party by, you know, the John O. Johnsons of the world and the Mary Eastons and the Michael Eastons and, you know, great Labor stalwarts like that. And Lou Herman, the great Labour mayor of Ashfield for many decades, you might remember him, Lachlan. And one of the things they so prided themselves on was not just the working class tradition and, you know, the social equity purpose, but their capacity, for example, to reach out to new constituencies. You know, the brilliance that Labour had through the 80s was in part, for example, building those relationships of trust with newly arrived Australians, with ethnic Australians, right? And it's almost as if the Labour Party has virtually consciously decided that, for example, ethnic Australians who now constitute 40 to 50% of the vote in the metropolitan areas are not of interest to them. I find it extraordinary.
Look, this is a challenge for the Labour Party, but this is what we've always done is, you know, Whitlam effectively within the same brand reinvented the Labour Party. Like there was the working class Labour Party, and then Whitlam completely reinvented it to be a coalition between the working class and, you know, inner city progressives, however you want to describe that kind of thing. That coalition was brand new. It never happened before. And Labour has been good at doing that. But it's been a single brand strategy, you know what I mean, throughout that time. I think the edges of the feasibility of that single brand strategy, which is happening in pretty much every other industry in the world, is finally catching up with politics. And what used to be a disadvantage for the Libs, and the Lib-Nat fusion was itself only a creation of Labor Party success. Labor just has to accept that what we did to the Liberal and National Party, the old Free Trade and Protectionist Party, people are starting to do to us. And we can either refuse to accept that reality and kind of honourably kind of watch our primary vote fall from low 30s to 30 and then not even have the pretense of forming government anymore. Or we can say it's time to adjust our missions to important, to not be willing to kind of look for new partners and allies in order to form government, in order to achieve our mission. It's not depressing, it's just reality. And, you know, that's politics. Like, we happen to be a very long and very stable party, but we are still subject to the laws of political gravity, and they're kicking in, and we've just got to accept that and adjust our strategy accordingly.
Can we talk about polling and how every single published poll called it wrong for this election? What happened, do you reckon, Pete?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's start from the basics, that when we are talking about public polls and then we are talking about internal party polling, we are talking about two entirely different species. So it is completely logical that you're getting different outcomes in public polls that work to certain briefs using certain methodologies as opposed to internal polls, which work to very different briefs and very different methodologies. You know, in fact, Hearst today said that the internal polling was tracking where they thought it would end up today. So, yeah, it's apples and oranges. It's like watching the Leichhardt Wanderers under 12s as opposed to the Balmain Tigers. You know, they're very different levels of sophistication, very different levels of inquiry. They don't do things like explore motivation to a great degree.
It gives you a
point in time in one day, right? It's like turning on your GPS and the GPS says your longitude and latitude right now is X. But what you really want the GPS for is to tell you how do you get to your destination. And that's a fundamental difference between the public stuff and the internal party stuff is the internal party stuff is usable information as opposed to stuff that's kind of produced to, you know, let's have a good giggle about where the politics of the day is up to. Sorry, I'm cynical.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, polling is grossly misunderstood in Australia, and it's not. What's surprising is not that the polling was inaccurate. It's that we all genuinely got to the stage where we believed it was all accurate.
Exactly. Mm.
You know what I mean? That was the oversight. Polling is a Photoshop, is a photo of a horse race at its best. And at 1,000 voters in a 10 million person electorate, it's a photo
before
of a horse race from the moon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so this is an incredibly small slither of information which tells you very little. Over the years, I think what's happened is we've had some pretty much fundamentally more predictable electoral outcomes, and that's built up this impression of infallibility around what is a highly fallible art at that level, at a like, who's going to win the election and I can only afford to do 1,000 voters. As you proceed closer to the election and you narrow down the kind of the group that you're trying to determine, whether it's out of 90,000 voters and you're calling 1,000 people and you're 6 weeks away, that becomes accurate. You know, are we going to win Bass or not? Although I would say in this case, Labor's internal tracking polling was clearly completely inaccurate. There is no doubt about that.
And how much influence does that have over the the strategy and character of the campaign that you're running?
Well, if you decide to allow it that it's infallible, it has unbelievable kind of influence. And the reality is there's a level of proximity to the campaign and limited nature of the insight you're searching for, like what's happening in a seat, that polling does have a long history of being very effective. You know what I mean? So what is surprising, I think, about the polling is that Labor was internally, based on what should be very reliable numbers, making very bad decisions. And I only say that based on one thing. The level of confidence displayed in the campaign could only lead you to the conclusion that the actual internal polling was deeply wrong. We could have had the best pollster in the world or the worst. Maybe we should have been more... They would have allowed us to correct course a lot earlier. But my sense is by the time they were really sharpening their advice, would have been almost too late in terms of everything was cast.
No, that's a very good point.
Whether it was, who Labor was appealing to, who the leader was, what the policy framework was, how we're selling it. But yeah, there is just no way of sugarcoating it, is that the profound nature of the misunderstanding of what the electorate was telling us in very small places like, a seat in Tasmania. I mean, there is reports, how accurate they are, is that there was a suggestion that we were going to have a profound swing to us. There was a genuine belief in the campaign that Tasmania was going to be very successful for us.
But your point is right, is that, a myopic focus on whether or not who is your pollster, how good is your pollster, is the poll accurate, et cetera, et cetera. It's more kind of a media interest than it is a campaigner's interest. Because at the end of the day, walking through a Westfield, talking to mothers on the sideline or dads on the sideline at a football match, all of these things are just as important for a good campaigner and a good campaign as the raw data of a poll. Mark Texter, again, considered the greatest pollster this country's ever produced, used to laugh. And, he'd say, oh, the 433 bus from Glebe to the city, that means 43.3%. And what Mark was really trying to say is that, if you have this kind of blind adherence simply to what the numbers are coming out of these polls, rather than doing what you're elected to do as a politician, and that's respect and listen to the community and come up with ideas for our future, then you're actually not being very responsible.
Yeah, because I would take a hazard a guess that the whole big end of town stuff, that feels like to me that was all driven by polling,
right,
basically. And this is a classic example where it can send you a false signal in
Correct,
some ways,
yeah.
Is I would say the polling was saying, yeah, we love that top end of town stuff. But what it didn't deal with is the fact that Labor spent 20 years creating this entrepreneurial working class Australia, basically.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the whole point of all of those reforms in the 80s and 90s was to create this new class of people. I don't mean class in the English public school way. I mean a new version
new
of ordinary Australians, you know what I mean? A new vision of themselves. And it was fundamentally inconsistent with that, our legacy, to suddenly come out and say, no, it's all about redistribution and that's all. Because people were like, we were sending you on this journey up this ladder, and then the next thing we're like, oh, but the people at the top of the ladder that we built for you and want to send up are absolute assholes and we need to steal their money. And that polling can't, when you say to someone, what do you think about sticking it to the big end of town? They go, yeah, stick it to the big end of town, good on you. What polling can't tell you is what happens if you take the alternative and people make a deep and instinctive choice about, is that the Labor Party that I used to like, and all that sort of very complex stuff. And so it's incredibly useful. It's also unbelievably dangerous and at times deeply ineffective.
Yeah, Neville Rand's great quote. And when I was a candidate for Balmain, believe it or not, I was crazy enough to try at one point in my sort of interesting journey in 2007. I door knocked on Neville Rand's home, his former boyhood home in Balmain. The lady who answered the door was running her own business out of Neville Rand's home. She was doing like a web design company or something like that. And she reminded me of Neville Rand's great quote. And it was based on the experience of her own family having grown up in Balmain. And she said, the best part of being working class was getting out. And, and when you do things like the big end of town, you listen to it and you go, hang on a second, that runs completely contrary to the very valid and legitimate aspiration that Labor has created, and that is to lift people up rather than to put them into this position of diabolical conflict with some bad guy out there.
All right. Well, I could happily let this run on for the next hour, but both of you have got real jobs in the real world that you need to get back to. So thanks so much for coming in and joining me.
Pleasure.
So much fun. Lachlan, that was awesome.
Thank you. Enjoyed it, Pete.
Lachlan Harris is the founder of consumer network One Big Switch, and worked as a senior advisor for former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. Peter Schmeagle has been a senior advisor to 8 Liberal ministers or premiers,
and used to work for Liberal-aligned polling and strategy company Crosby Texter. Jessica Elgood is the director of Ipsos, which did the political polling for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age in the lead-up to the election. Jess Elgood. Welcome, Jess.
Hi there.
Can you please start by explaining to me how you conduct your polls?
So the polls we do for SMH and The Age are conducted by telephone. It's a mixture of ringing people up on landlines, but also mostly ringing people up on mobiles as well. And in terms of the phone numbers we ring, we randomly generate those numbers. So we don't get them out of the phone book or anything like that. And the idea there is that whether your name is listed, your number is listed or not listed, you've got an equal chance of taking part. And that's a really important bit of our methodology so that we can make sure we reach anyone across Australia.
And how do you know that you're getting a spread across the country?
So we're working hard to make sure that the people we actually achieve interviews with are a match to the census data. So we're really, really reliant on ABS data. So getting that mixture of not just the right number of people by age or gender, but also by location.
So the SMH and The Age published an Ipsos poll on Friday. You had Labor at 51% on two-party preferred and the Coalition at 49% on two-party preferred, indicating that Labor was going to win the election on Saturday night. You actually called the Labor primary result as being surprisingly low. In recent polls, Ipsos has consistently had the Labor result surprisingly low, which people were sceptical of. That result turned out to be right on the night, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It was remarkably close. We were really pleased with the accuracy there. We came closer than some in relation to the Coalition vote. Our data in that last poll showed a 3-point pickup in the Coalition share of the vote. So we did see some sort of late movement towards Coalition in our data. So on the two-party primary vote, we feel pretty good about the job we did there. Where we need to improve is if you look at our Green share of the vote, which we've long had at a slightly higher level than some other pollsters. And we now, here we are in the second election where, again, it was a little bit too high. So we've got work to do on that.
So is that your explanation for why you had, on the two-party preferred, the Labor Party winning the election?
It's not the only explanation, Terry. There's a whole load of things going on. And at this point, after all elections, polling companies sit back and do a huge, great big post-mortem and trying to understand. Because the reality is, from each election, you take lessons. And each election is quite distinct and has different lessons to be learnt. So we know, and we've known for a while, that we're picking up too many Greens. And we have done various things to try and understand what's going on with our data there. So we're going to continue to look at that, and we have some ideas. But in terms of why we had Labour slightly ahead there, I personally think, from what I've seen of polling globally, so, you know, we work in Australia, but I used to run the polling in the UK, and we know over recent years, one of the challenges for polling companies is we tend to get too many politically engaged people who say, yes, they'll do the survey. So while the data demographically matches all that lovely census information we get, you're getting people who possibly are a little bit too hooked into the news and watching those things. And that delivers a slightly more left of centre movement in the data. So that's one of the things we've been watching. It's very, very subtle, but we've seen it happen recently for colleagues in the Canadian elections. I think it's got something to do with what happened here, but it's not the only thing. There are other things. Some of them is whether or not there was a late swing in the data, in how people are wanting to vote. Some commentators are saying they saw that, others didn't. I'm at the moment minded to say I think that did happen. I was always brought up as a pollster with the adage that he who polls last polls best. So if you can be polling right up to the last minute, you've got that chance of picking up any late movement. So there's that question, was there a late movement? Was that movement to Liberals something that happened right in that last week? I don't know yet, but that's something that could be part of it. Some people have raised the issue of what in the UK was called shy Tories. Mm. So i.e. right-wing voters who don't want to come out and identify with voting to the right.
Do you believe that theory?
I don't buy it for Australia. It doesn't sit right for me. Shy Tories was back in the days of Margaret Thatcher when it was a very divided situation there and people didn't want to come out as being a Tory.
Although people have raised it as an issue in the United States that people didn't mm-hmm. want to say that they would vote for Donald Trump, but then they did vote for Donald Trump.
And I think to a certain extent it makes sense in the United States. But those two, you know, we're all Western democracies, but the UK and the US, are they different in terms of how people identify in relation to politics? They're more divided. It's more significant in terms of how you see yourself. Whereas my take on Australia is actually we don't talk about politics as much and we don't define ourselves with those labels. And being blunt, we have friends who sit on the other side of the political debate, whereas in the UK, sometimes you don't. Mm. So at the moment, I've not seen evidence to suggest that's what's gone on here. But like I say, it's a post-mortem. It's about learning the lessons. Mm. So if that comes through, that's something we're going to have to think about how we address.
I want to read you a paragraph from a piece by Professor Brian Schmidt that he wrote for The Guardian earlier this week. He's a Nobel laureate in physics and vice-chancellor of the Australian National University. He said, for the 16 polls conducted during the election, based on the number of people interviewed, the odds of those 16 polls coming in with the same small spread of answers is greater than 100,000 to 1. In other words, the polls have been manipulated, probably unintentionally, to give the same answers as each other. The mathematics does not lie.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to that?
I think it's fascinating. And I think I know that at the moment within the industry, there's moves for an industry-wide review to be set up. And I'm pretty confident that's going to come to pass. I think there's definitely something in what he says. Clearly, if we share some things like just not just what we do, but also actually literally our data. And if you can see the difference between unweighted and weighted data, i.e. when we get the data, we apply statistics to make sure that the data matches those demographic details
and
we get
from
the census. We do that. I'm sure everybody does that. It's a very standard way of doing it. But the question is how much you have to do that. What I'm getting at there is how much your raw data looks like the population and how much you have to do to it to make it match the census. Now, part of what we're doing when we're interviewing people and ringing up landlines and mobiles is working really hard to find that demographic mixture, to find that one older guy who lives in rural Tasmania, whatever it is our sample needs. And then we try and apply as little weighting as possible. The more weighting you're putting, the more you're essentially moving the data around.
Do you publish the raw data?
We have not published it. And that's partly because nobody else in the market does, to my knowledge. But I would imagine we'd be relatively comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
And I think it would be useful because it was uncanny. And equally, in the months running up to the election, there was some discussion about the way Ipsos's polling data was seen to be jumping around. Now, for me as a professional, I felt pretty comfortable about that because, A, the political environment was moving. And also the nature of the polling is that you will move around a bit. There are confidence intervals related to the work. It's really slightly boring for most people, but when you take a figure from one of our polls, our last poll, for example, we knew that it was reliable to plus or minus 2.3 points. So there's a bandwidth, shall we say, for each answer. And that's just the statistical model on which the polls are based. So for them all to sit so steady and so close together, for me, suggests that there might be something in that quote from The Guardian. And I think maybe that would be good for the review to look at.
So you think other pollsters might be manipulating their data?
I have no evidence to say that, but I think I think when you take the picture as a whole, I think it requires examining. Mm. I know what we do with the data. I know that we did not consult or talk to any of the pollsters at that stage of the game. That's not really what we're about. I don't see any point in doing that. It is statistically unlikely that so many land in the same spot, but I'm not going to make that accusation. It's a heavy accusation and requires some evidence.
So finally, Jess, the readers of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, why should they trust polling at any point in the future?
Well, I think if you actually go back to the primary figures that you opened the interview with, Tori, we're actually pretty close. Yes, I totally take it on the chin that we called it wrong. We did think Labour were going to edge this one. So absolutely, I'm not denying that. And, you know, we need to learn from that. We need to move on. We weren't that wide of the mark. I think you just need to get a little bit of balance on that. And so, you know, should they trust it? Well, I think with all statistics, when you're consuming statistics, you should be having a really good, rigorous look at what it is. Who have they interviewed? What have they done to that data? What's it actually saying? Are there lessons to be learnt? There are a lot of lessons to be learnt. And I think of how we go into the next election will be different. I think one of the things we need to take more notice is more contextual surrounding information. And I think possibly that's another learning point. But should they trust it? I think they should be intelligent consumers and be critical and think about what they've got in front of them. Or we could also go down the route, you know, in France, you don't have any polling published in the last 2 weeks before the election, if I remember correctly. So, you know, there are some countries where they consider that it's actually creates unnecessary noise during a campaign. So that's another route.
It's certainly going to be harder for politicians to use polling as a reason to knock off a sitting prime minister.
Yes, it certainly is.
Which might be a good thing.
It could be a good thing.
All right, Jess, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guests this week, Ipsos Australia Director Jessica Elgood and our panellists Lachlan Harris and Peter Schmeagle. I really hope you enjoyed Please Explain's election coverage. I loved getting all your feedback and ideas. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is in the show notes for this episode.
Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscribers power our award-winning journalism, and it's never been a better time to support us. Just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. Thanks to the team behind this week's episode. Production and editing from Nicole Priestell and Debbie Harrington. Amelia Maguire does all our logistics and planning. David McMillan takes care of all of our recordings. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori. Thanks for listening.